You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 144. Finally, 12 squared. We got there. So my guest today is Amy Therese, and she's somebody I started following on Twitter a while back, and I've just been incredibly impressed with her thinking, her observations, her erudition, and getting to know her a little bit more. I discovered that she is a podcaster as well. She just recently started co-hosting a podcast, and she has appeared on another podcast with some really interesting analysis of some of these centrist intellectuals and why ultimately what they're doing is frustrating and a little fraudulent in some ways. So I'll let her talk about that, but this is a really interesting interview. Amy also happens to consider herself to be a socialist, and I thought with all the people that I have on the show and all the opinions I talk about on the show that tug our Overton window to the right, I thought, you know what, I don't that often, you know, I've interviewed Dan Errol once and argued with him the whole time, but it's not that often that I have someone way left of me on to drag that Overton window the other way. And I thought this would be all kinds of good opportunity in many ways. And as it turns out, Amy has academic credentials as well. She's a very smart person. She's a very educated person. Lots to learn from her. But one note I have to make, she also tends to curse like a sailor, so which I found quite endearing. So this is an explicit episode, just a warning in case anybody's worried about that kind of thing. There's some cursing in it, but I didn't want to take away from the authentic Amy Therese. I was not at all disappointed. I don't think you will be either. Let's get to my interview with Amy Therese. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Amy.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been following you for a while, and I've heard a few things that you've done, and I'm really blown away by your thinking and some of the analysis you've done, especially of Pinker and these centrist intellectuals that you did on, what was it, Revolutionary Left? Is that the name of the podcast?
Yeah, Rev Left Radio.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was asking if you had done that on your show before we started, because I was like, yeah, I'd rather plug your podcast, but I guess you did all that brilliant research for someone else's podcast. So that's awesome already, I just want to say. But you also are a co-host of a show. Why don't you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, so I just recently started co-hosting Dead Pundit Society, which is a socialist theory podcast that it was started last year by Adam Proctor, sort of in the wake of the 2016 kind of disaster that was. He sort of thought, hey, like, we on the left need to sort of get serious and think a bit more critically about the way we approach things. So that was sort of his focus going in. And then yeah, so I came on board for the second season a couple of months ago, and yeah, I've been really enjoying that. So
excellent, that's really cool. And briefly, do you mind going into your background? Go ahead.
I originally did an arts degree, majoring in philosophy. So it's usually pretty helpful at encouraging people to overthink just about everything, which comes quite in handy in the political realm. And then I'm now doing a graduate law degree. So, but much of my focus is also like critical legal studies, which sort of looks at law from a vantage point of asking sort of critical questions as to whether the law is achieving what it sets out to achieve, in addition to whether we're asking the right questions in terms of what we want it to achieve, if that makes sense.
Kinda,
basically,
yeah.
It's a school of thought that emerged out of like critical theory. And it basically takes like the type of questions that critical theory would ask in like the cultural and political realm, and it sort of applies some of those critical lenses to the law.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I didn't even think of that as a field existing, but that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And so basically, so sometimes what happens in the law is that it can be reproducing certain inequalities despite looking like it's coming up with perfectly reasonable outcomes. And so a critical legal studies perspective is one that sort of attempts to excavate some of those notions and really make sure that like what the law is seeking to do is something that we want it to do, but additionally whether it's actually achieving those ends substantively.
That's so interesting. So that answers the question of why, because I know we interacted a bit on about intersectionality, and you were approaching it from
one of my hobby horses.
Yeah, no, that's I might want to touch on that later, but yeah, but before we get to that, let's talk about what we were talking about before we started recording, which is where we are on the political spectrum, because I think it's interesting. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is you label yourself as a socialist, and I don't think I give socialism its due on my show in any real way. You know, like, I'm not a socialist, but also when we're talking about Overton window, you know, like, I feel like I'm constantly addressing and talking to people more to the right of me. And maybe it's, you know, time to shift that window a little left sometimes and talk socialism. So
yeah,
I thought that would be fun.
Sure.
Do you want to talk about that? What that label means to you, I guess?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm not so sure how useful it is once we sort of like, you know, that tendency to sometimes get really sectarian about it. Like,
yeah.
I'm not super fussy in that way, but certainly like broad outline, like to me, a socialist is someone who has an orientation of critique towards capitalism, and that the capitalist.
Well, I guess I'm a socialist then.
But see, the thing is, I think that lots of like people who would describe themselves as sort of progressives, I think even if not explicitly, they're often to a really large extent like influenced by sort of social democratic theory, even if they're not like consciously identifying themselves as such. So for instance, like I know in the primaries for the 2016 election, like you supported Bernie, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. True.
And so like I certainly think there's an enormous overlap between like a social democratic approach and people who would call themselves like progressives or sort of left liberals. But I guess the more substantive difference between sort of a democratic socialist and a socialist is really just one of degree, not kind. And basically the difference is that, like, as I see it, social democrats haven't quite reckoned with the inherent contradictions of capitalism, and they're prepared to sort of stop a little bit before someone like myself would be prepared to stop. So I fundamentally think that there's no way of achieving broad and overwhelming liberation whilst capitalism is still in place. I think that market logic is fundamentally unjust. And I think that, like, in my ideal world, markets and market logic and the hierarchies that it reproduces and produces and the fundamental exploitation that's required for capitalism to exist is not something that I think can be justified. Like, it's unjustifiable. And so that would be, I guess, the primary difference between like a progressive and a socialist, is that like a progressive may be prepared to like go a significant way in terms of certain policies, like, you know, Medicare for all and like maybe a jobs guarantee or a universal basic income or something like that. But ultimately, like, they're still significantly more okay with markets.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I think that's where the central sort of
that's interesting
difference might lie.
Yeah, I want to talk about, okay, there's a lot to talk about there. And I think one thing that I don't think you do, but that some of the socialists that I interact with do, and I think it might be interesting to talk about for a minute, is because, yes, I consider myself a progressive person. I did support Bernie. And I'll tell you this, like, one thing that I think should be true or should be something we could unite on is we both want more socialism. Or if, you know, if someone listening out there is a socialist in the US or whatever, like, that person and I are going to both want more socialism from now. So, like, I feel like we should be able to kind of unite at least for part of the journey. And then if we ever get to a point where it's like, okay, I'm like, all right, that's enough socialism, and they're not, then okay, then we'll be somewhere else. But what I find frustrating is that there are a lot of people who insist that if progressives, no matter how progressive I might be on any other issue, you know, no matter how much I might, and you just touched on some of them, healthcare for all or universal basic income, or just I personally want way higher taxes for rich people. And all that. And it's like, no matter how much of that and how much, you know, socially too, like, you know, I want to bring awareness to trans issues and proper use of pronouns in accordance of what people want and all this stuff. Like, no matter how much of that, there are people who will get on me on Twitter and yell at me because as long as I think markets are okay in some capacity, then I'm like just as bad as the next Republican. And I know that's not you, and I know that's finding an extreme example, but I seem to encounter that a lot. And I'm not using that to say all socialists are bad, but it's something that I guess I want to say, like, it frustrates me because I think how, depending on your philosophy, you're able to say, like, if you think markets are the most evil thing in the world, then you're able to say any Democrat, no matter how liberal, as long as there's a little bit of like market in them, there's like an ounce of marketness in them, then they're just part of the problem. And I feel like that can be destructive.
Yeah, there's a lot there. So first and foremost, I just want to kind of reframe it a tiny little bit and say, like, the way that, like, for, okay, sorry, just trying to figure out a way to attend to everything. So first and foremost, like, something that Adam and I are incredibly persistent with on our program is, like, that purity politics nonsense, that, like, personalized approach, like, posturing yourself as, like, an ultra-leftist and being a fuckwit to anyone who doesn't share your exact, like, niche little label, and, like, cornering yourself off into, like, this little leftist ghetto that can never win. That's cancer for the left. Like, that is the last thing that I think any substantive socialist should be doing. Like, that is it's a fundamentally individualized framing. It's a way of, like, branding yourself as, like, leftier than thou by sort of giving shit to people who aren't as left as you. And, like, it fundamentally misses the point. Like, to achieve the type of ends that we want to achieve, we can't do that just with people wearing a magic cape named socialism. We need to be appealing to as many people as possible, and that is going to take reforms. And with certain types of reforms, you enable people to see things differently and come on board in different ways. So, right. For example, like, right now, the vast majority of Americans have, like, a capitalist boot on their fucking neck. Like, for the first time, this current generation of millennials looks set to have worse life outcomes across a whole range of indicators than their parents did. Like, this system as currently constituted really limits the way people are able to think about things, what they're able to conceive of in terms of the political realm. And so what we think is really important is what we kind of refer to as non-reformist reforms, right? So there's sort of a critique on the left where people will be like, oh, you know, if you just want Medicare for all and you're not worried about, like, A, B, C, and D, then you're just a reformer and you're not a real lefty, and blah, 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 which is exactly, you know, it's sort of shades of the same thing you've referred to experiencing. And, like, we don't have any time for that, because the thing is, those reforms basically are non-reformist reforms, because what they do is they enable a whole world of possibility. They change the structural conditions for people in really monumental ways. So, for example, like, right now, the fact that healthcare is so inherently tied to employment, it really crushes people in myriad ways, and it limits the possibilities of what they can think of, what they can attempt to do. Like, if you're stuck in a really heartbreaking daily grind of a job, but, like, you can't even attempt to, like, think about, you know, say if you had, like, an entrepreneurial idea or like a, something that you're more passionate about. But like, you know, if you have young children, like the fact that healthcare is tied to your employer means to a large extent you're chained to your employer in very real ways.
So absolutely. Like, well, and not to mention all the student loan debt everybody is saddled with right now. Well,
that's another perfect example, right? So the way we see it is like, it's not about like idealism. It's not about like selling people this perfect radical vision and talking about fucking guillotines and all that type of nonsense. Like that to me achieves nothing. What achieves things is changing the material conditions that shape people's lives. And in doing that, you'll tend to find that you change the ways people are able to conceive of what they expect politically as well. Like by making people's lives less relentlessly grueling, to open up conditions of possibility. And so I think just you know, demanding this like ultra purist nonsense, that's a real issue on the left, and it's something Adam and I like really relentlessly focused on. So you're not just alone in sort of seeing that as problematic.
You're like, my kind of socialist. That's good. All right. I love it. Yeah.
And if we get like if Adam and I get our job right, like we want all the socialists to sort of be that way. Because the other thing I just remembered from what you said before, it's not about capitalism and markets being good or evil. It's not about, because that's like inherently about individualized motivations, and it's kind of a moralistic framing of things. We don't take issue with capitalism because we think that all people with lots of money are bad people. That's right, that's not the case, and that's not the point, right? The point is that structurally it is a system that necessarily relies on taking more value out of people. It relies on exploitation. And so that's why it's fundamentally a problem.
Right. And my question, what I'm thinking of is, I don't even know that I care to focus on that, because like, I kind of disagree, you know, like obviously, which is why I'm not a socialist. Like I think that the overwhelming good that markets can do, I think China would be an example of, once they unlock their markets a little bit, are thriving so much. And I'm not an expert on this, so you feel free to push back. But it just strikes me as, that's a country where as flawed as it is, and as much as it's a bit of a dictatorship in some ways, and is, you know, there was a great Last Week Tonight just covered a lot of the things she is doing in China. But I think the fact remains, no matter, disregarding all that, the fact that they opened up their markets and that prosperity has really, really lifted up just hundreds of millions of people who wouldn't have been lifted up otherwise. I think if I were to state my, maybe where we disagree, it would be in that I think capitalism can do so much good in terms of lifting everybody that it might outweigh the if done right, then that good would outweigh the I don't know, the discrepancies in the people in the top, the people at the bottom. And what I mean by that is, it would also have to be coupled with higher taxes and all kinds of programs that would allow people to have a strong baseline of well-being. But I don't even know if I care to focus on that debate, because that's just the minor difference between the socialism that you're expressing and the democratic socialism maybe I might lean to. And I just don't know that I care about that difference all that much, because we're nowhere near that in real life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, if I could, like,
sure.
Two things. Are you ready to have actually, I'll explain this part. In response to the end, you don't care to focus on that because fundamentally in the here and now, it essentially doesn't matter. Like it's an axiomatic difference, but it's not one that has fucking anything to say about activating and mobilizing as many people to the polls as possible for the midterms, right? It says fucking nothing about that, and it's an irrelevant thing to focus on. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And there's no way to operationalize that in a particularly useful way in the here and now. None. Right? So I'll grant that right off the top. But if you're ready to have your mind blown a little bit, and I think...
Sure, always ready.
Some left liberals are perhaps not quite as familiar with the theoretical underpinnings behind, for instance, like most Marxist thinking. And the funny thing is, like, we actually totally agree in relation to like the most monumental historical change in bringing the largest quantity of human beings out of poverty, at least grueling, grinding poverty, has in fact happened in the last 20 years. And it is in fact due to liberalization of the Chinese markets. Like, no doubt, that's absolutely correct.
Thank God. Okay. I'm glad.
Yeah, no, like, we don't deny reality, right? But the thing is, a Marxist understanding of capitalism will tell you that that trajectory is one that we expect. Like, our critique of capitalism expects that in relation to China, and it expects that in developing nations as they develop. Like, it necessarily creates, like, a more comfortable existence for the people within those societies. Like, that's not something that we deny. We totally acknowledge that. And that's a beautiful thing. But the problem ends up, like, it, fundamentally, liberal capitalism will eventually have to come face to face with its contradictions. And so the way that that happened in the West, like, what we were able to do was outsource a lot of our production to other countries for much lower prices and all the rest. And then so, like, for instance, China now is changing dramatically in terms of the degree of skilled labor that its economy is producing. So rather than just being sort of sweatshops and garment manufacturer, it's moving to a lot more high-tech industries. And then some of those, like, much less skilled labor will be moving to areas like Bangladesh and other sort of less developed nations in the region. And that's, to a large extent, really predictable. Like, the way that capitalism works is that it seeks to increase, or the rate of profit tends to decline. And so capital needs to find newer ways to extract value. And so that means that ultimately, like, when we run out of developing nations to which we can outsource our production for lower costs, like, it eventually runs up against the contradictions inherent in the structure of capitalism. Now, we've still got plenty of, you know, developing nations, and we still have plenty of fundamentally disempowered groups that we can continue to exploit.
Yeah.
But we have only one planet.
yeah, we've got to unlock another planet of labor at somewhere, free,
exactly,
cheap labor.
Exactly, like, and just...
No, that's a great point, you know, and that's something that I don't think, I don't know that I've reconciled, and I don't think a lot of Americans ever end up reconciling, is everybody's somewhere in their brains is aware of the fact that everything, you know, every piece of clothing, everything we buy is made in China or made in wherever it is now, you know, and, but there's a tension between that and, like, the trade deals that Trump stupidly thought were, like, badly negotiated. He just knows Obama did it equal bad. He doesn't know, like, what any of the and honestly, for him, it might be that we need to be exploiting these people more. Like, it's not as though he has the right version of why these are bad deals. But it's weird because we think Americans deserve these high-paying, you know, potentially sometimes low-skilled jobs, but then people in other countries don't. Like, we still deserve to buy things for nothing because we can exploit people
but,
in
I mean,
another country.
It's also in many ways not just a matter of, like, deserve. It's also a matter of, like, neoliberalism has exerted myriad pressures on the majority of Americans, and it's not even about, like, locating a sense of, like, moral blame in terms of consumers purchasing things that were made in less than ethical fashion. It's like, if your minimum wage is $5.50 an hour, and you're working, you know, three jobs to try to keep a roof over your family's head, I think it's absolutely repugnant to expect that individual to not be shopping at the Walmart that's opened in their town and not be taking advantage of the fact that the consumer options there are far more affordable than they are in certain other places. So, like, locating the blame and the responsibility within individuals is fundamentally something that socialists are not about at all. Like, we look to the structures and the way those structures shape our relations to each other and to our labor and to our purchases to a large extent. So to us, it's very much like a relational thing and a structural thing, not something that is like about like moral decision making on the behalf of individuals. Like, not at all.
Yeah, interesting. It reminds me also, somewhat related, I would hear this argument from, I think it was like Bill Maher or something, who would his immigration argument was like, I don't understand why these conservatives are against immigration. You know, like, what do you want to pay $10 for a pound of cucumbers or something? Like, essentially the argument of like, you're going to have to pay a lot more for your produce. And my thought was like, is that the reason you're pro immigration, is because we need to have like essentially slave labor? Like, that's not the reason I would be pro-immigrant. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't sound like a good answer. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just going to say, it's like, on the one hand, I appreciate how sometimes people will frame things by citing a particular outcome or reason why it might appeal to a certain person, right?
Yeah, like, but trying to frame it in conservative terms.
Frame it that
maybe,
way,
yeah.
Sure. But the problem with that, and I think this is something particularly like people who've had a bit of a cringy new atheist or skeptical type phase, like something that we can really get behind is like, it actually matters not just like the end line of what you think, but it matters like your reasoning that got you there. Because if the reasoning that got you there is shitty, like, you're in no way, like, it's not a principled stance, and there's no guarantee that like that you'll reason in a good way in future, right? Like, I would much prefer to take an argument that is well thought out, even if I disagree with the end line, than like someone who has the same outcome as me, like, i.e. pro-immigration. But if their reasoning is because labor is cheaper that way, like, that particular rationale can have some really toxic effects if we apply it in different areas, right? You don't want that to be the animating reason behind your advocacy, because that's a really poison pill to swallow. Like, you want... But at the same time, like, sometimes it is, you know, effective if you frame it that way. I mean, the tragic irony is that the border was only, they only began intensively policing it in the mid to late 80s. And the nature of long-term undocumented immigration has completely changed since then, where previously it was a dynamic back and forth. People
right, would
come
they would go
to
and
seasonal
work and
employment,
then go back.
Right?
Yeah.
And that would be very much like a push-pull based on the seasonal work. Whereas now, because the border is so grueling and such a risk, people will come and they will stay. There's none of that like back forth that there used to be. Mm-hmm. So there's modeling that suggests like there would have been dramatically less undocumented immigrants
absolutely
residing long-term in the U.S. had they not policed the border that way. So, I mean, on the one hand, it is tempting to argue with conservatives in that way. Like, literally what you are doing isn't even achieving what you want it to do. But it's also just fucking immoral, right? Like, it's reprehensible and it's gross. And
yeah, there was something... It was weird because I've heard this line of thinking a little bit, you know, unfortunately, I expect it from conservatives, but even sometimes liberals, which is it's almost this racist thing of like, look, white people don't want to do those jobs, you know, like, so we need this immigration to do those jobs. And I'm just like, what? That sounds worse than than some conservative arguments.
And this is where I think like a leftist understanding will actually shed a lot more light on what's going on. It's not so much white people don't want those jobs. It's that the capital, like the people running those fucking farms, want to exploit workers to a relentless extent. And if you are a legal citizen, you cannot be exploited to the same degree because you have rights in that country.
Absolutely.
You know?
And my
like,
thinking is whatever.
And so it's not about individuals. It's about a set of structural incentives at play.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that we never, you know, as has been pointed out a lot lately, we never go after the businesses that much. It's always, let's go after the people who have been, you know, here, not the businesses who have been.
Because your government has been fundamentally captured in a really corporate way. Like, you don't even need to be like a leftist or a socialist to recognize like the extent to which money operates so rampantly in US politics has a fundamentally distorting impact. They've done studies that suggest that even if 90% of the US population is in favor of something, if corporations, broadly speaking, are not in favor of it, it doesn't happen.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, just look at gun control. There are gun control issues. I don't even know if that's a corporate thing necessarily, but there are certainly gun control issues that 90%
of the NRA.
Yeah, but I would you
huge
call that
lobbying
like
a, power? But I think it's also much.
I think
more
it's a little different.
Like it's cultural too.
Yeah, that's
it's complex.
Right.
Yeah.
But still, that is definitely an issue where 90% of people think, you know, we want. I've looked at the poll, but whatever the measure of it might be background checks or something, and then we can't get it done. You know, there's a lot of that, and I think, I mean, my personal view. This is branching off, but I think the corporate right has been really good at keeping the ordinary right wingers population of this country engaged in a culture war, so that they don't notice some other things that are going on.
But let's go. Speaking my language.
Yeah. Let's go back. Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to say. Oh gosh, you mentioned. I wanted to address it because you said about earlier on. You said you know, this this purity thing with left people, and I just want to touch on that because I think there are people who would think that that's me. You know, I think there are certainly people who would think, you know, Thomas is the kind of guy where if you're not progressive on certain issues, then like, fuck you, I'm not going to talk to you kind of thing. And I just want to make sure that, like, I don't know, I kind of want to address that because for me, like, those issues aren't necessarily where you are on certain political things. But for me, it's like sexual harassment and racism. Like, I do feel like if you are someone who, and I just mean general, if there's somebody who is kind of cool with sexual harassment or kind of anti-Me Too or constantly reactionary toward that, like I am kind of not really patient about that at all. But I guess it doesn't mean, I don't know, it doesn't mean I wouldn't vote with that person. You know what I mean? I guess that's where I would draw a distinction there.
The way I like to look at this is like, it's worth kind of explicating whether we're talking about a political orientation or an interpersonal one.
Right.
And like, in an interpersonal sense, like, I have no fucking interest in spending any time with people who are racist, comfortably racist, in like subtly racist, like any of that shit. I have no time for it. Like, I find it sickening. And like, I don't even envisage myself getting on with someone who is incidentally racist. Like, I just can't imagine striking up a friendship and then like suddenly being shocked when they bring out like the big racism. Like, I just no, right? But I am far more prepared to attempt to build political solidarity with people whose, for instance, like their vernacular might not be especially woke. Because to me, that's not good. To me, that that can be a justice issue. And I think it is very easy as someone who is incredibly privileged and incredibly educated and clued in and linked into the kind of networks where you learn how to code your language in ways that are not offensive. And you learn like the latest, not so much euphemisms, but like you learn sort of a particular social vernacular that people in other circumstances are not clued into that. And so I think to presume that, for instance, like unwoke language necessarily signifies like a bigoted attitude or a more substantively an egalitarian worldview, I think that's a mistake. And I think it's a mistake politically because if you exclude everyone who doesn't use woke language, like you can't win. There's going to be a significant portion of people, like for instance, my grandparents, like my dad's a migrant. And before they met my dad, they would have been relatively like racist in the way they talked about certain things or whatever. But like meeting my dad, having three beautiful, like half immigrant kids, like their understanding of things completely changed. But even now, like they might use words or ways of framing things that are not woke, but like they don't want to, like they want the same things as us. They're just fucking working class Aussie like bogans. Do you know what I mean?
I do. So I don't know what the last few words you use mean, but I do know what you mean.
It means like hillbillies. It's like the Aussie version of hillbillies, right? So their language won't be woke, but like I never want to be like alienating people on something as superficial as that.
Does
but
Australia have liberal token, hillbillies? We don't have those here mostly. We have only like two. Are your hillbillies in Australia liberal? Because ours here are almost never.
Liberal? See, it's really ironic because actually here our conservative party is called the Liberal.
I forgot about that. I did know that, actually. I forgot. Yeah. that is confusing.
But it actually really varies. I think in like the last 20 years, the sort of the right has done that like race baiting shit that to a large extent they would capture people whose economic interests are not actually aligned with their politics, much as the same way as has happened in the US since kind of the Southern strategy, like very similar. But there's a significant class diversity, like of voting habits.
Okay.
Are not necessarily tied to a class. Like there's a lot of like people who are just like Labour voters through and through, even though they might be like sort of a bit bogan and vice versa. It's not as easily segregated.
Well, I think ours is not, when you talk about class, I think we're similar, but when you talk about rural versus city, that's where our huge divide is. So when I think of hillbilly, I think of rural, and that's very, very red. Let's see if I can use it. What are terms that will translate?
Our split doesn't occur in the way that yours does, that's rural versus non. Ours is much more diverse than that.
Yeah.
Because also one of the significant differences between Australia and the States is the way that our electoral boundaries are drawn up. Mm. We have an independent administrative body known as the Australian Electoral Commission, and they just basically split up electoral boundaries just based on population data. So rather than all the gerrymandering and fuckery that goes on with packing and cracking of electoral districts over there, we don't have any of that shit.
Gerrymandering. Explain this. How do you get around gerrymandering? Explain this for me. Well, I'm gonna bring this technology.
you know how your electorates are drawn up as a parliamentary process every 10 years or 5 years or whatever it is.
Ten years. Should be 10 years.
So we have a statutory body that's formulated, like, you know, Parliament passes a law that formulates an independent administrative body that is completely apart from the government of the day. It's an independent body. It's funded by the government, but it is statutorily constructed as completely independent of the whoever's in parliament.
And it actually somehow remains independent? That's the part that
fundamentally independent.
Wow. Well, cool. Yeah. Good job.
Yeah, so they just do it on population data. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And all our electorates, they try to have like roughly exactly the same number of people and stuff. So it's...
honestly, it's not that easy to know what's the perfectly fair way to do it, even if you are trying to be objectively fair. Like, it is a tough mathematical problem of like, in a given state, do you, you know, let's say it's 55, 45.
Well, it's always going to be like within reason, right?
Right. But it's not exploitatively gerrymandered ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But ours, because ours is independent and there's no like political gain. And it's also, it's not a thing here.
But okay, so getting back to what I was going to say on that issue, though, is I think what happens, and this is bringing it back to the very parochial considerations of, you know, within like this little atheist community that I still seem to be a part of, because I've gone back and forth, but I guess I'm going to be back to being a part of. just in my own head, like it has nothing to do with anybody else. But anyway, I think another thing people are doing is interpreting criticism of any kind as like, you're just willing to throw me out based on one little thing. So like, because we're going back to that purity issue, you know, it's the easiest thing when someone says, for example, just off the top of my head, when someone talks about how Netflix has a you can't look at anyone for longer than 5 seconds policy when they really don't have any such thing. And that's just a bit of fake news. Oh, sorry. This is a personal battle of mine.
Missed that. Netflix has a no staring at people.
No, it doesn't. 5 seconds. 15 seconds. What happened was Netflix was doing harassment training, and one of the things that said in the harassment training is, hey, if you look at someone for like longer than 5 seconds, that could be uncomfortable. Like if you just, you know, if you're just staring at someone, that could be considered uncomfortable.
Which, you know, we'd love to live in the type of world where instructing people that creepily staring at people for extended periods of time is, funnily enough, going to strike individuals as creepy.
Right.
Unfortunately, we don't quite live in that world yet. So we're just going to throw this in the training manual just in case.
Well, yeah. And that is a fundamentally, in my opinion, completely non-controversial thing to say. Hey, this could be creepy.
It's funny that we had to put it.
Exactly.
In, you know?
It's just like, no, thrown it in shows. There. Yeah.
But
and then what
to be
happens
fair,
is.
There are probably neurodiverse people. I think that's the right way to say it. Like people who perhaps are on the spectrum.
That's
where
fine. Yeah.
That may not, like, sometimes overtly, those.
Well, let me finish,
I don't
let me
speak
finish what
people,
I was saying.
But that may be of some vague utility. I don't know.
No, maybe. I know. It's whatever. We have to cover the basics because you have to be able to say in your policy.
Exactly.
You know,
from a legal standpoint, too. Like, we did
instruct
X. But anyway,
got through like 10% of what I was saying. So, like, what happened was then that. Employees didn't like that, or they thought that was, you know, too far or something, or took. So what happened was this publication, The Sun or whatever, this like online whatever.
Tabloid.
Interviewed some people and they said, oh, Netflix is saying we can't even look at each other. And then they like quoted them as that. And then The Independent shared it with the headline, Netflix enforces no looking at each other for 5 seconds rule. And then Seth Andrews shares it as though that's fact. And I, you know, pointed out.
Some fucking clickbait bullshit.
Exactly. And clearly. So what the only reason I bring that up is it doesn't mean that I'm saying anybody who shared that should be put to death or something. And it doesn't mean that I wouldn't vote liberal with you or vote, you know, like, but I still find it valuable. Like my pinpoint issue, like my hot button issues, I guess, right, for me mainly right now, are things involving Me Too and things involving Black Lives Matter. And those are really important to me. And I'm going to be critical of things like that, where I think people are falling short, but it doesn't, like, it does. People have a thing where any criticism is looked at as, okay, then you're being divisive then, you know? And like,
okay, so
go ahead.
If I could, two things. I think first and foremost, not just for any political orientation, but social groups, any kind of collective project, any kind of vague alignment or allegiance of any kind, community group, whatever. If you don't have a robust culture of debate within that particular group, then you can't function, right? So to interpret criticism or disagreement as abuse or to overinterpret what someone means when they make a particular critique, then it's just in bad faith, right? And so someone like Seth Andrews, I don't follow him personally, but to the best of my understanding, like, he comes out of that atheist, skeptical type orientation. So to just be unflinchingly sharing bullshit clickbait, it's a performative contradiction as to what he purports to represent. And so
I should have used those orientation,
you're just saying, hey man, like, if you're a part of this thing that I'm a part of, and if what we say we care about is like rigorous thinking and being critical and not being just a dumbass, like, you're sort of like letting down the whole team on this one.
Can I,
like,
hire you to do my social media and just use better phrasing than I can use because you're more erudite and well-spoken?
Oh, cheers, mate. Like, but seriously, like, it's just, like, and if you can't handle that criticism and either say, no, I get fucked, like, if he wants to say that, that's fine, but then he looks like a total douche, right? Or you say, right, I hadn't thought about it that way. I guess I must have just got so wrapped up in the story and, like, found it so extreme that I was like, wow, mate, like, you, but you raise a good point. I'll take it under advisement, or I'll rethink that next time. Like, It's not that fucking hard.
I know. Okay, say, well, let's go to something else because...
Maybe I got it wrong.
Yeah, whatever. I know. That's what I think, but sorry, this was a little self-indulgent for me to bring it back to this place because it's just what's on my mind. Let's get back to you.
I get it, for sure. I think that's what's happening. But it was,
it's the divisiveness thing, which is, I think that where it matters, though, let's bring it back to the discussion of politics. I think where it matters is... Who are you supporting politically? You know, because like hypothetically, if Seth Andrews tomorrow were running for office and I was going to vote between Seth Andrews and a Republican, no matter how critical I am of him on this issue, I'd be like, okay, well, I will vote Seth Andrews. Because to me, I'm not disqualifying an entire person politically because of one thing they said. I just might criticize it. Right. I know that was a bit of an awkward ending, but I've got a story behind that. So what actually happened right there was I quickly said, you know what? I've been it's foolish of me to bring this conversation back toward my Seth Andrews thing. And I tried to take the conversation back towards politics. And I was going to make a point about and actually, I never ended up making it. So maybe I'll make it now. I was just going to make a point about politically, even if you are a socialist, it's my view that really the only viable path toward socialism in the United States would be through the Democratic Party. I can't imagine. I mean, even if I were a socialist, I would still be supporting Democrats because the way to get things to be more left is by getting left people in power. It is not by putting the worst kinds of people in power and allowing them to nominate Supreme Court justices who are very young and who will ruin the system forever. I just don't think that's the way forward. There are a lot of people I interact with on Twitter who attack both parties equally. And there's nothing, again, as I say all the time, there's nothing wrong with criticizing one's own side. And in fact, it can be very good. But once it borders on both sides are exactly the same is where I have a real disagreement because they just are not. They are not the same. I will die on that hill. They are not at all the same, no matter how many weaknesses and how many times the Democrats have fallen short, which they absolutely have. They are just not the same. And the idea that the better way forward, again, just under the premise that you are a socialist, the idea that the better way forward is not to empower the far left Bernie or progressive wing of the Democrats and try to move them into more power. Not by doing that, but by alienating everyone, forming no kind of coalition of any kind, not voting and discouraging others from voting, and then step four, question marks, and then step five, profit. Or I guess since you're a socialist, not nobody profit. The idea that that's the way toward successfully turning the U.S. into a socialist country, that is absurd to me. I just think that's the most impractical thing. And there seem to be people that I interact with who think that. And if you're a socialist and you don't think that, then sorry, I'm not talking about you. I am talking about very specific people I've interacted with. And I personally, I have no way of gauging how many people that is. So I apologize. I don't want to be using like, oh, these are just a few bad examples to badmouth socialists. I hope I'm not doing that. But I do indeed just have no way to gauge what percentage of socialists that is, except those are the ones I seem to hear from a lot. But I will say, I mean, Amy was an example of somebody that I could agree with a lot on and who I think understands that you have to do some sort of consensus and coalition building and that you're not going to revolution your way into a socialist utopia. It's just not going to happen. At any rate, that was what I was going to say and get her response from, but that didn't happen. What happened was I started to say that and Amy interrupted, which is totally cool. But she said, sorry, I want to talk about something else. And she launched into a conversation on Me Too that I found really interesting. And I don't even know exactly what I should say to describe it, except that we started a discussion on Me Too. And I don't want to put any words in her mouth, but I'm just introducing this because she described an experience she had. And then we had a pretty rigorous debate about Me Too. And I think it'll be interesting for you to listen and to see which side of that you fall on, if indeed there are defined sides. But this is all to say that there's going to be a part two with Amy because this part two was actually even longer than part one. It was like an hour. And it was really fascinating. And I am immensely curious for your response on it. I'm also curious for your response on this part one, of course, but that this was came out of nowhere, but it was very worthwhile. So I've got to get to editing that, because this turned, again, this turned from what was going to be a one episode recording to a very lengthy, longer than a two-parter, but I got to take it down and edit it down to a nice two-parter and get that to you. But in the meantime, thank you for listening to part one. I'm going to get part two out for patrons and supporters at seriouspod.com/support and patreon.com/seriouspod. I'm going to get that out to you sooner. It'll be early for you guys. And also, if you haven't heard it already, supporters, I did a bonus episode where I spoke very candidly about some of the Facebook drama that I was involved in, and the Seth Andrews situation that I just referenced was one of those things that I spoke about, and I wanted to get your feedback. And I've gotten feedback from some supporters, and I appreciate that, because, you know, I'm genuinely not 100% sure that, you know, what I'm doing is like the best way to go about things, and I'm open to feedback, but I also think there's some false dichotomy happening there. So tune into that. If you're a supporter, make sure you got a hold of that if you want it, and email me if you're having any problems with the feed or anything like that. But thank you, folks, for supporting. You are making the show happen. You're the only reason the show happens. And supporters can also look forward to this part two early. But with that said, it is time to call it for this week. And I want to reemphasize that no matter the fact that I called out Seth Andrews for posting what I think is fake news, I would still vote for him tomorrow if he were running on the left, because I just use that example to show that it's not necessarily a purity politics, you know, like what's the line between a purity politics and merely a healthy call out of one side? And that's what I'm trying to figure out. And I think that's what a lot of people are trying to figure out. But all that aside, thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Amy. And man, I'm really excited for you to hear part two next week or earlier for patrons. And I'll have to say that I will see you then, folks.